You know, Michael, I think the best way to kill a person is with a gun or knife. Don't you?
Actually, no. I like something that's a little more difficult.
You do? Well, we're going to have to talk more about that.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Hi, I'm Brad, and the voice you heard at the opening is my guest, Michael J. Wilson. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's good to have you on.
Thank you.
Now, sometimes I chit-chat a little bit with the guest before we start discussing their books. But I think for you, that's where we need to start to give folks a frame of reference.
Okay.
So tell us about your no guns or no knives policy. What does that mean?
Well, I follow a no guns or knives policy for the instigating murders in my Mourning Dove Mysteries series. That's not to say guns and knives don't appear in the books, but they're not the weapon used in the opening murders. My mystery novels begin with a bizarre death that could just as easily be the beginning of a supernatural story. An ice skater becomes trapped on a lake that erupts in flames. A man crashes into a 30th floor window of an office high rise with no other tall buildings around. A strange orb of light floats from a TV screen to explode with lethal force at the slightest touch. Before my investigators can deduce the killer, they must first figure out how the deed was done. I like to compare the book series to The X-Files, but instead of Mulder always being right with his supernatural explanation, it's Scully with her scientific explanation.
Oh, I like that. And I got to tell you, in the first novel, The Murder on the Lake of Fire, that poor young lady, the ice skater, I really felt bad for her.
I did too. I hated doing that to her. But
I generally don't like to change a point of view, but I do like at the beginning of a novel when things are seen from the victim's point of view, and then we switch. It's a good way to pull somebody in, and it was very effective in yours because I did care, and I was sad.
Good.
I wanted justice done.
That's great. That's what the book was about.
When you first sat down the keyboard, when you started the Mourning Dove Mysteries, did you say, let me think of a bizarre way to kill someone, or did it happen organically?
Okay, so, well, first off, I have to go back to the beginning, the very first book I wrote that, unpublished book, but it was a dark adventure story about a 15-year-old boy in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. After I started wondering a few years, I just put that book aside. I filed it in my file cabinet and didn't think much about it until a few years later. I started wondering what this 15-year-old boy would be doing now. And after everything he experienced in that first book, I thought that he would go into law enforcement. And so that's where I came up with the idea. Well, I should do a mystery series with this character as an adult. I didn't want to, I love like Agatha Christie and David Baldacci, all these others who use guns and knives, but I just wanted something a little different. And I was such a huge fan of the X-Files. I thought that it would be cool if I started each book kind of like an X-Files episode where you don't know exactly what's going on. And so I needed a good opening murder, and I actually dreamt it. I dreamt of someone just with flames all around. They're on a frozen lake with flames just erupting all around them. And so I used that as the opening murder. And then I had to figure out how to do it scientifically, not supernaturally. So.
Yeah. And you know, if somebody didn't know they were reading a mystery novel, they would think that they were reading a Stephen King novel.
Right.
Because it did seem supernatural. You know, she's out there on the ice and suddenly things burst into flames. Well, that doesn't happen very often.
Right.
I don't like fishing, but I lived in Michigan for a while. Well, I lived in Michigan a good part of the early part of my life. And during ice fishing, not once can I ever remember a fire happening. So good job on that.
Well, good.
I want you to pick one of the three novels, and you may want to start with the first. This is called Beyond the Blurb. And it's your chance to tell us why we should buy the book. What is the story?
Well, apart from the fact that the lead detective is gay. And I know there are several book series out now that do feature gay detectives, but it's not the norm. And I do it in a way where when you first read the book, you don't know he's gay. You don't realize that it's done in a natural way. We find out about, I don't know, a third of the way into the book that he's gay. And then he meets someone who could be a suspect, could be love interest or whatever. But I really enjoy that aspect of it, writing someone like me as a lead, as a protagonist of a mystery series, because I love mystery series. I love mystery books, but I never read anything with even a gay character in it, much less as the lead detective. Like I said, I love supernatural tinges, and I put that in all of my books. There's always something that just borders on supernatural. Like in the second book, Death Opens a Window, one of my main characters is called the Crick Witch, and she's an old mountain woman, and everyone calls her the Crick Witch, and she's a great, great character. I mean, I'm not bragging about my writing or anything. I just really love this character. I fell in love with her, and I loved writing her. So, if you're going to read one book in the series so far, there's three out, I would choose Death Opens a Window. So just because I really love the characters in that.
And there's nothing wrong to know that you wrote something well.
Yeah.
When you can pick up the book 6 months, a year later, and you think, I would read that.
Yeah.
It's a good feeling. And actually, a guest that I had on recently, I don't remember who it was, asked me, have I ever written a standalone? And I said, no, but I did start a thriller novel. And as I was writing scenes, my heart was racing and I was sweating. And I realized I'm on the right track here.
Right.
I never finished it. I'll get back to it eventually, but you know when it's good.
Yeah, I have a lot of those unfinished works too, so they're in my file cabinet.
Now, this takes place in the Smoky Mountains, and you mentioned the Smoky Mountains earlier, the short story, I guess, that turned into Emery. Is that who it was?
Yeah, it was actually a complete novel. I just never did anything with it. I put it aside, and now I use it as backstory for Emery Rome. So I'm continually drawing on that first novel and filling in his backstory using that. And in the fourth book, the one I'm writing now, we go all in on that backstory. And so it's actually going to be kind of a current time and past.
Now, you're from Tennessee. Did you live in the Smoky Mountains or near them?
I lived near them. I am from Tennessee, born and raised, and I visited the Smoky Mountains quite a bit, so I am very familiar with the area.
Yeah, I lived on the other side of the mountains in North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
And I would drive the Blue Ridge Parkway quite a bit, did a lot of hiking up there. It's beautiful, just absolutely beautiful.
To me, it's a cool setting. I mean, there's lots of books in the city and stuff like that, but I kind of like the rural feel to it a little more. I mean, this book is set partially in Knoxville too, which is real close to the Smoky Mountains.
And that was my thought when I was reading it, that as beautiful as the Smokies are, they can be dark and mysterious as well.
Right.
Very much so. So there's three investigators in the story. There's Emery, Jeff, and Virginia.
Right.
And they all have very distinct personalities. Emery certainly has some issues he's dealing with. Give us a thought of each one of the individuals. Tell us about them.
Okay. Emery Rome is an introvert with a mind for science and a traumatic past, which has been hinted at, like I said, with his backstory, but we won't be fully explored until book four, which I'm writing now. Jeff is gregarious, jack of all trades, with an enviable physical prowess and secrets of his own, which we discovered at the end of Death Opens Window. And we will explore that a little later on. Virginia is a beautiful soul and people person with an affinity for research and hidden talents that will come to light in future books. Emery is half Native American. Jeff is Caucasian and Virginia is Black.
Very diverse crowd.
Right.
You don't always see that in the South.
Yeah. But in Tennessee, it's like most everyone claims to have some kind of Native American heritage. So.
And they probably do.
Yeah.
You can get more information about episodes, plus scoops on book releases and promotions by LGBTQ crime authors each and every week. Simply head over to queerwritersofcrime.com and sign up for the newsletter. Brad made it easy and put the link right here in the show notes. Need a little nudge? Click it now and you'll also get a free ebook by one of a select group of outstanding authors. That makes not subscribing just plain silly. It's all yours at queerwritersofcrime.com.
What is the craziest thing you've seen that did wind up in your books?
Okay. The craziest thing, I have put a few real life moments in my book. I can tell you one that happened with the LAPD.
Sure. That always sounds interesting right away.
Yeah. And I put it in Death Opens a Window, happening to Emory. But I was in a 7-Eleven getting ready to go to Axe's, and I was there. I don't smoke anymore, but I was getting cigarettes. And all of a sudden, this guy punches me. And I was completely dazed. I was there with a friend of mine. And anyway, we sort of got into it a little bit. And the cops were called, LAPD. When they arrived, they separate us. And my friend Barry was over listening to what they were saying to the other guy. And the policeman actually told him, if you say he grabbed your ass, then we'll have to take him down too. And then he won't press charges or whatever. And so Barry came over and told me that. And then sure enough, the policeman came over and said, he said you grabbed his ass first. And so I'm going to have to take you down too. Do you want to press charges? And I said, no. And so I put that into, Death Opens a Window.
What a shitty situation.
It was shitty. It was very shitty, and it stuck with me, and I couldn't believe it. I did nothing. I seriously did nothing. I was walking around the aisles. I can't remember where we were getting something to drink to and cigarettes, but then just out of the blue, this guy comes around the corner, just punches me. Yeah. Got away with it too, thanks to the police.
And you'd never seen him before?
No.
I actually have a false tooth because I was at a party and this guy, all I remember is this guy stepped in the door and said, there's that fucker. And I went blank. And I was told that he lifted me up and threw me against the wall. Yeah, he thought I was somebody else.
Oh, wow.
Some other handsome person had caused some trouble and I got the brunt of it.
Yeah. No, I didn't know anything about this guy. He knew we were gay and of course, I wore tight shorts and probably didn't have a shirt on at the time. So he just, he just wanted to get out that aggression, I guess.
So there's a question I try to avoid asking because it's one of the things that comes up when I ask guests an awkward question, because it's a question we get a lot as authors, and it's a really hard one to answer. So I'm going to break this rule with you. How the hell do you come up with these ideas?
Well, it always starts with the opening murder for me. I think of that before anything. And like I said, the first one, the ice skater, that came to me in a dream. I think the man going through the window of the high rise, that came to me while I was showering or at the gym. I can't remember, but it's always during these innocuous times. Like I'm running through it in my head and just keep it in the back of my mind, trying to think of something that would be cool to see. I think of it like a movie. It's like, what would be something really bizarre to see, a strange way for someone to die? And it just stays in my head. It could be weeks before I come up with the actual idea. And then after I do that, I have to make sure I can actually explain it scientifically. Like there is a way for someone to kill someone this way. And there's been lots of times I've come up with bizarre ways to die, and I could not explain them. So I had to abandon them.
Well, you make me feel like a hack, because in my first novel, the person was killed with a knife. And my third novel that I'm writing right now, they're killed with a knife. And I'm not doing a spoiler because Blade is in the title. You know what? My fourth novel, I'm going to have to try and think of something interesting. See if I can outdo you a little bit.
Okay. No, and like I said, I have nothing at all against that. I love Agatha Christie. I grew up on Agatha Christie, and it was always a gun or knife, just about, or an icicle, or poison. But nothing at all against that. I just kind of wanted it to be, like I said, kind of an ode to X-Files, where it seems supernatural, and you can't really do that with a gun or knife. So,
I agree. I think it was a good choice on your part. It made it interesting, and it's particular to you.
Right.
You told me that when your novel was published in French, that you were flown out to Rome for book signing.
Oh, yeah, in Italian. The first two books have both been translated into French and Italian. And yeah, so when the Murder on the Lake of Fire came out in Italian, I went to Rome for a book signing there. So that was pretty exciting.
And I just embarrassed myself because I am aware that Rome is in Italy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it sounded like I think it was in France. Yeah, Rome is in France and the Eiffel Tower is over in Italy. That's the way it works in my world.
But it was cool because we were there also for Gay Pride just happened to coincide. It was the next day after my book signing. So we got to experience Pride in Rome, and it was in 2019. So it was before the pandemic, before everything shut down. But just absolutely wonderful experience. I never thought I'd be signing copies of my book in Rome. And that was an amazing experience.
How was Pride? Was there any difference than
Pride was amazing. Yeah. It was cool. It was just, we were right there by the Colosseum. So you got the Colosseum in the background and, you know, we got our mandatory kiss in front of the Colosseum with the Pride flags in back and stuff. So it was like I said, a great experience that whole trip.
I wonder what the ghost of those ancient Romans were thinking at that particular moment.
Yes. Well, they were probably pretty gay friendly, so.
It depends on the book you read, but yeah, I think
yeah.
The reason I find that fascinating is, for the most part, the days of, if they ever existed as much as they're shown in television and the movies, the days where your publisher did all kinds of marketing for you and sent you around the country, around the world to do book signings, that for the most part is dead, except in rare circumstances. Usually now when you go on, when you're hired by a publisher, they say, okay, how many people do you have on social media and what is your marketing plan?
Right.
And of course, I would say, my marketing plan? What is your marketing plan? You're taking a big chunk of my money.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool that you had that opportunity.
Yeah, but I'm with you on that. Unless you're one of the really big names, the publisher doesn't really do a lot for you as far as marketing or expenses or anything. It's all up to you. And it does depend on things like social media, your following, and how well you can market yourself, which I've never been comfortable with, but I've tried to get better at it. So.
So you did this book signing in Rome, which is pretty exciting. There was a time when you were homeless, which is quite a bit of difference.
Right.
Let's start with the beginning. You were it was your second year in college in Tennessee.
Right.
And you picked up and you took off to Los Angeles. Am I right that you told me it was you hitchhiked?
No, I was in college. It was 2 weeks before the end of my sophomore year. I just couldn't take it anymore. Tennessee was not, at least at that time, was not a great place to grow up gay. And I wasn't flamboyant or anything like that. It still was just it was a horrible experience. I mean, I tried to kill myself twice in college and I was just like, I got to get out of here. And so I didn't even wait to finish my sophomore year. I sold my little 74 Grand Torino, got $200 for it, bought a Greyhound bus ticket for $100. It took 3 days to get out to LA and went. I showed up at downtown LA station and I got a cab.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I know. I had no idea. I just LA, so I should have done better. I should have done Hollywood or somewhere else, but I did LA. I was in a fraternity at MTSU. That was my college I dropped out of in Tennessee. And I was in Beta Theta Pi. So I took a cab to the Beta House at UCLA. I showed up on the front doorstep and I introduced myself as a Beta from Tennessee. No warning. I never told them I was coming. I just asked them if they could put me up for a while. And they tested me to make sure I really was a Beta. And they let me stay in their trophy room for a while. And I had a two-way bus ticket. So if things didn't work out, I was going to go back. But I was out job searching during that time, and I passed by the Spike in West Hollywood. And I was like, that's got to be a gay bar. And I said, so I'm going to try to go in there. And so I did. I was 19 at the time, so I had to get a fake driver's license or a fake ID, which wasn't a problem because the bartender at the Spike told me to just go across the street and they did them there. So so I did, and I came back with my ID and he served me. But I met someone there who I told him I'm just going to go back to Tennessee because I haven't been able to find a job here. And he said, well, don't do that. You can stay with me. So I ended up getting my stuff from UCLA, staying with him for a little bit. And then I stayed with someone else. And this guy, the second guy, was kind of a wannabe cult leader. He had someone else that was living with him. But he got mad at that guy and kicked us both out. And I didn't have my ticket anymore. I had no money. And all I had was a suitcase. And I ended up panhandling for 2 months on the streets of Hollywood. And I would get the newspaper and see if there's anything that I might be that might be good for me. And I kept going on job searches. I would clean up in the service station before they'd open up. They had there's this chain link fence around it. And I'd break in, I'd clean myself up, and then take a bus to whatever the job I was applying for. And eventually there was, I worked in a pharmacy when I was at MTSU. And so I applied at pharmacies, and there was this one called Santa Glen Pharmacy. The manager was gay, and I think he just kind of took pity on me and gave me the job as a pharmacy tech. And it was probably my second paycheck. I was able to get this roach infested apartment on Sunset, just off Sunset. It was like $290 a month. So, and after that, I just kind of crawled my way back up.
There are so many homeless kids in kids, I'm talking about early 20s on down to much younger in Hollywood. And when you walk by in the evening under a bridge, walking down the sidewalk to get somewhere, you have to get out into the street because there's so many crowded on top of each other.
Right.
To get some sleep. First of all, what was it about LA that drew you to come out here? Because it sounded like you didn't know what you were getting into.
I didn't. I wanted to get away from Tennessee, and it was a toss-up between LA and New York, and I chose LA because of the weather. And you mentioned age. I had my 20th birthday on the streets of Hollywood. I was homeless for my 20th birthday. So
I'm trying to think if we could have a happy birthday for you. I'll have to think something. Were you surprised when you got here and the streets weren't paved with gold and everybody wasn't blonde, beautiful, and out and sunbathing every day?
I tell you, I always had kind of an easy time like getting jobs in Tennessee. I worked at, my father was an attorney, and I worked at his law firm in high school. And then when I got to college, my minister got me a job at the hospital I was born at as a pharmacy tech. And so I didn't think finding a job would be so difficult. But when you're fresh into town and don't really have a permanent address, no one wants to hire you. So that was back then. That was surprising to me that I wasn't able to just quickly get a job and land on my feet and get going. So, yeah, it was rude awakening.
Yeah, it calls to a lot of people. And whenever I have family come into town, you know, they want to go down Hollywood Boulevard to see the Avenue of the Stars. They are always very disappointed. You got the stars on the sidewalk, but you have lots of check cashing places, and you can see drug deals going on right in the street. And they're trying to clean it up. Actually, years ago, it was worse. And Mickey Rooney, for those of us much younger, he was an actor. He started a campaign to clean it up, and he wasn't very successful. But it's coming along. It's coming along. It's getting better. But it's still not, you know, this glamour place that everybody thinks of. There's no movie studios left except for a couple. I know Jim Henson's studio is there, and there's a few small ones. Paramount. It's
Sunset Gower.
Yeah, Sunset Gower.
Is that still there? That's where the Golden Girls was filmed.
Yeah, that actually used to be Desilu. That was Lucille Ball's studio. You know, they all left Hollywood. But yeah, it is such a lure, and I think it's a big letdown for a lot of people to come out and see it the way it is. LA is a great place, and there are some wonderful things, but it's not perfect, and Hollywood especially. So you were in LA, and what took you to San Diego?
Oh, let's see. I worked at, I mentioned pharmacy tech. Well, I had quite a few jobs when I was in LA. I was a bartender at Studio One for 2 years. I worked at Century City Hospital as a pharmacy tech. I worked at UCLA as a pharmacy tech. And a friend of mine who worked at Cedars-Sinai, he was in the marketing department at Cedars-Sinai. He knew, of course, he's my best friend. He actually from Tennessee, too. His name's Ty Kennan. I named Virginia after him. Virginia Kennan has his last name. He asked me if I could write some brochures for some of their services instead of writing fiction, write some nonfiction. And so I started with that. And then I eventually Cedars-Sinai hired me in their marketing department. And then my friend Ty moved down to San Diego, and he brought me down a little bit later. And so that's how I ended up here. But I've been here for 15 years now.
San Diego is a beautiful city.
Yeah, yeah. I loved LA too. I love California, anywhere here. So
when I worked for Marriott, when people would transfer to San Diego, their wages weren't any higher because there were so many employees that wanted to live in San Diego, they didn't have to. And it's an expensive city to live in.
Right.
But something interesting happened to you in San Diego. And I'm going to tell you my little story and how that compares to your little story. Okay. You know, I'm from North Carolina. I think the area I was from, it wasn't in the hills. So it was probably a little more open than you were. I was in one of the small, very small liberal meccas in North Carolina. But I did go to Atlanta and I said, you know, I'm going to go to a gay bar. So I found the one of the gay rags that you don't find anymore in the racks. And I found this bar and was on my way there. And I was scared to death. It turns out it was a leather bar. And these guys in leather were coming out, walking down the street. And it scared me shitless. And there was no way I was going in there. And I ended up in a drag bar. And actually, it was a fabulous show. So I'm glad that happened. But that was my first experience with a gay bar. And I was scared. And I was a little nervous in the future for a while. You, however, went to your first gay bar, and I don't know what your experience was like what was going through your head, but the very first time you go to a gay bar, you met your future husband.
Well, actually, it was the very first time I went to that particular bar.
Oh, okay. Well, so, you confused me.
I apologize. No, this was actually years after I bartended at Studio One and all that. It's still there. It called Pex in San Diego. I lived right down the street from it, and I'd never been. And I'd been to a Padres game and got a little tipsy, and decided when I got home I wasn't ready to be home yet. So I thought, well, I'm just going to try out that Pex bar and see what it's like. And I was in there for probably 10 minutes when I spotted this guy, and a big old guy, 6'3", just just really handsome and everything. And I started talking to him, and we were probably in the bar for 10 minutes before we left, and the rest is history. So
my husband is 6'3". It's a nice height.
Yeah, it is.
Did you come out at all in Tennessee? Were you out in any way?
So this is my thing in Tennessee. I never lied. If someone outright asked me, are you gay? I would say yes, but I never brought it up either. You know, had a handful of experiences in Tennessee before I left. So I was in no way comfortable with it or, you know, out there outing myself, but I never did lie about it either.
So how was the comfort level when you got to Los Angeles and moving past that discomfort level? Do you still have that?
Not at all. That left pretty... it left pretty quickly after I got to LA because I was bleach blonde and, you know, young. And so it was pretty easy to get the right kind of attention. I mean, good gay attention as opposed to, oh, that guy's gay, and bad attention in Tennessee. It was a good thing in LA. And so it, especially when I started bartending, that really brought me out of my shell. And because I was wearing just these tight lycra shorts and no shirt and had a bunch of guys around me, you know, I was serving them drinks and stuff. So it was real easy to get out of that discomfort once I got to LA.
You sound like you adapted quicker than I did, because I still struggle with it.
Oh, really? No, I'm good.
At times. I mean, sometimes my husband would convince me to let's walk down the pier holding hands. And other times there was like, no way. No way. Now we're in a very red part of the state and we definitely don't do it here.
Well, I'm in North San Diego County, which is pretty conservative.
Yeah, but that's almost Orange County. Or that is Orange.
Yeah, it's just about. But I don't care anymore. So
good for you. I like that attitude. Hopefully I'll get there. I came out 20 years ago, so it's a gradual change for me.
Yeah.
Okay, so you wrote the three stories in the Morning Dub series. And then something got in your craw, and I'm curious. You switched and wrote a science fiction metaphysical novel called The Lost Vortex, Sedona. Do I have that right? Or did I...
So actually, it's a little bit reversed. I wrote Sedona first. Here's the order. I wrote the initial story of Emery Rome when he was 15 and never did anything with that. And then I was kind of lost. I was, you know, been living in LA for a few years and I felt lost. I spent in 1999, I spent 2 weeks alone camping and hiking in Sedona, seeking some new direction for my life. And it inspired me to write this book about the mythology of Sedona. And so I call it a contemporary fantasy / sci-fi story, Sedona, The Lost Vortex. And so that was actually my first published novel. We just did a 10-year anniversary edition this past year. And so, yeah, that's probably the confusion in the timeline because, yeah, I had my three books out and then we came out with the 10-year anniversary for Sedona. And I just, there's something really magical about that place. I don't know if you've ever been to Sedona.
I love Sedona. I love it.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, it's. I lived in Scottsdale for a while and went to Sedona as often as we could. Just loved Sedona.
I do too.
What's interesting about Sedona is you've got the people in their four-wheelers driving around, you know, wherever they let four-wheelers go scooting. And then you have the folks there that are there to meditate and are very spiritual. It's a real mix.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful country, very beautiful. And it's funny, I don't know why I got confused because I know you had that 10-year anniversary because it was something I want to ask you about. You had a really interesting marketing campaign where you put people on a scavenger hunt.
Oh, yeah. So, well, the book deals with, like I said, the Sedona mythology, and that includes crystals, healing energy. So that's a really important part of the book. It also, the antagonist of the book is a reverend. So it's this religious leader who is very anti-crystal cult, as he calls them. So I think it's an interesting story, but I have, so for the 10-year anniversary, what we did crystals for 8 of the characters in the book, and we hid them in places where those characters visited in the book. And I posted clues on YouTube and social media as to where those crystals were. But it was clues like you had to read the book to know exactly where they are. And so as of right now, five of them have been found. There's three still out there. I think it was $100 gift prize for an Amazon gift card for anyone who found them. And if you found all of them, it was going to be like $1,000 bonus, but different people have found them. And so I've gotten some great feedback from it, from people who found it. They're just people visiting Sedona, like hiking along, and they just saw something, they spotted something and discovered it. And they're just really happy about it. And they, of course, want to read the book after that. But I just really love the entire, everything about Sedona, the scenery, the mythology. I'm going to revisit it. I'm actually working on the sequel to that in addition to the fourth book in the Morning Dove mystery series. I want to do a trilogy of that Sedona story.
Well, and I was going to ask you about doing more science fiction in the future, but I want to bring back up the scavenger hunt that you did, because when I saw the videos, I was like, I wonder if that's still going on. Now we know there's still three out there.
Yes.
So you're kind of like Thanos.
Yes. Yes.
What happens when you get all the crystals? I don't know. I don't want to know.
Yes. Well, see, now they're separated. So if the same person had found them, their power would have been to receive $1,000 bonus or something.
So you started in science fiction. So I presume that's of interest to you. What took you to mystery? And let's say when you were younger, before you started writing, what genre did you read most?
Definitely read mystery most. Agatha Christie, like I said, I started out, the very first book series I read was Nancy Drew. I mean, I just loved those. When I was a kid, I read every one of them there were. I wasn't so much a fan of the Hardy Boys. That they didn't interest me for some reason. I really was drawn more to Nancy Drew. And then after that, I got my first Agatha Christie novel, and I just was voracious about it. Couldn't read enough, and I used to share those with my mom. We would be reading them at the same time, the same book, and I would take time and read a few chapters, and then give it to her, and she'd read a few chapters, and so we were always finishing about the same time. That was just a great memory with my mom. But yeah, I always loved mysteries. And I loved science fiction too, like Arthur C. Clarke. Just loved him. And so I've always been interested in both genres and didn't want to be kept in one and not able to explore the other as well.
I've always been mostly towards mysteries. I did read a lot of the Star Trek books, which are usually pretty cheesy, but some of them were better than the show because they could do things that they didn't have to worry about the set. A lot of people say that's why the cartoon was better than the TV series, because you weren't restricted to the special effects. And I hate to say this because I really hate Scientology and they have their Museum of Death. And for a person with bipolar, such as myself, for them to have this museum to tell people that psychiatrists are there to kill them, I have real issues with, which makes me have real issues with L. Ron Hubbard. However, I love Battlefield Earth. It's one of my favorite novels.
Oh, really?
I haven't watched any of the movies because I can't picture. I heard they didn't do it well, and I don't see how that book could be done well unless it's, you know, multiple, like Lord of the Rings.
I saw the movie. I didn't read the book. And yeah, the movie was not particularly great.
Well, I don't know who gets the money, but just in case, get it from the library or borrow it from a friend.
Yeah.
No more money to him. I live in the Mojave Desert. And so you told me something that really interested me. You are a professional skydiver, but no, you're a licensed skydiver. I did some parachuting, which I absolutely loved, and it was by the tandem. I didn't parachute with a person, but when I jumped out of the plane, it automatically opened my chute. And I did that four times, and it was fun.
Okay.
But I saw a guy whose chute didn't open until the very last second, and I don't remember making a conscious decision that said I'm not going back, but I never went back. You've obviously done a lot more jumps than that. What type of license do you have? Because I know it's 25 to become a licensed skydiver.
Yeah, so my license has expired. I had it when I was living in LA. I used to go up to the Mojave Desert and I took classes. I've actually never done a tandem skydive. I've always done it with my own parachute. But there was a class there in California City where they would, I think you could had to do like 10 jumps with jump masters where they're holding on to you when you jump out of the plane, mm-hmm. but then they let go and you've got the canopy ride all to yourself. So I'd done probably 40 jumps in all. I can't remember exactly. It's been a while. When I moved down to San Diego, I stopped skydiving because I didn't have a place down here that I felt as comfortable with as I did doing it in the Mojave Desert. It was just such an incredible feeling being up there, 12,500 feet and above the Mojave Desert, just beautiful desert as far as you could see, and the windmills of area right there?
Windmill farm near Palm Springs? No, that's not the Mojave.
Near Mojave. I can't remember. I think it begins with a T, Tehachapi or something.
I don't know. I haven't lived up here that long. I'm familiar with California City and all five people that live there, which it happens. yes. What's interesting is land-wise, it's the largest city in California.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yeah, it was part of a major real estate scam. Someday I'll tell that story, but you look it up, it's really interesting. It's really interesting.
But yeah, I used to jump out of Otters and Cessnas, but we would go over those windmills and then head back over to the jump zone. And no, it was great. I really enjoyed it. And I just, got out of it once I moved down to San Diego.
Well, if you stopped at 40, you were just 10 jumps away from a Class B license, which is 50 jumps.
Oh, really? Okay. So
you should have gone at least 10 more. And I noticed you said you used to skydive in the Mojave Desert. So I was thinking, he used the plural or past tense and not plural. He used past tense. I am a writer. I know what I'm thinking, just not, it doesn't come always out that way. And I was wondering why you stopped. I guess it was just the move to San Diego.
Yeah, that was it.
Have you ever talked to somebody that parachuted out of a balloon?
No. I've never done any base jumping or anything like that, or helicopter or balloon, but it interests me. I would love to try that.
Yeah, I don't know if I doubt I'll ever go parachuting or skydiving again, but people that did the balloon jumps said it was amazing because there's no sound. And you drop straight down.
Yeah.
Whereas when you jump out of a plane, you're still moving forward somewhat. And that always just fascinated me that it would be terrifying and exciting at the same time.
The best part of it for me, well, at least when I was first jumping, was you know how noisy it is when you first jump out of the plane. You get that wind just gushing by you. And then as soon as you open your chute, it's like calm, quiet. It just... That was an amazing experience. And then, but then after you've done that a few times, then you want to spend more time in the free fall practicing, doing different moves like tracking and, you know, flips and all this. So it changes. You get away from the quiet and want to stay in the noisy zone for a while longer.
Now, did you immediately, were they just jumps right out of the plane?
Yeah. So we took, I can't remember, like 3 or 4 hour class and practice with them. And then your first jump, someone goes outside the plane. You're at the door, holding onto the door, like the inside with one hand and outside with another. And then there's someone holding onto your strap inside the plane. And you signal to both of them that you're ready to go and let go. And so when you fall, you've actually got a man holding on to both sides, you know, your left and right side. And then they just make sure that you're checking your altimeter, that you're doing okay. And then once you're ready for to open your canopy, you wave them off and they go away and you're on your own. So.
I'm fascinated. It's a much different experience than I had because with the tandem jump, I had to climb out on the wing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, they told me that nobody has ever backed down before. And when they opened the door, I got really sick to my stomach. And then you climb outside and there's a little peg that you have one foot on and you're holding onto the wing. And then when you let go, the chute opens. I would have rather jumped right out than to be standing there on a wing.
I can imagine.
Waiting to be told to jump. So much different experience. Well, now we've reached the point for awkward questions authors get.
Okay.
what I do, I'll spin the wheel and you will get a question that will be awkward or irritating or rude that sometimes we get from readers.
Okay.
So hold on, and I'm going to spin the wheel. I have your question. Are you ready, Michael?
I'm ready.
When are you going to get around to writing a New York Times bestseller?
I'm always shooting for it. But you're right. There are questions like that you get a lot. And I'm small time right now. And hopefully one of these days it'll pick up a little more steam and I'll get on that list.
Well, I don't know if you experienced yourself. I have people I love that are very well-meaning that have said, you know, if you stopped writing these gay characters having sex, you'd probably sell a lot more books.
Right.
I'm going to write people like me. I'm gay and I have sex.
Yeah. There are lots of mystery series out there with straight people, you know, as the leads. I want someone who's more like me, like you said. And that reminds me of like, when I first came out with Murder on the Lake of Fire, I introduced Emery's homosexuality in a very nonchalant way about a third of the way into the book. And I received a few nasty reviews on Amazon, like, yuck, the writer should have warned us and all this, you know, that they were just appalled that he ended up being gay. And several people were saying that I should have put that in the description, but that wasn't the point of the book. The point of the book was the mystery. And it's just, that was an aspect of the protagonist.
Well, I hate it when straight people don't put warnings on their books. Yes. That really pisses me off. I pick up a book and it sounds good and, oh, then they are straight.
Yeah.
It's just wrong. Just wrong. All right. Well, it has been a pleasure to have you on, Michael.
You too. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I don't know. I think we met on Twitter.
Oh, I don't know. I don't. Oh, you're right. You're right. It was Twitter.
Yeah, I don't always know where I meet guests. Sometimes they meet me. Sometimes I meet them. But I always love when I get somebody on that hasn't been on before. So it's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.